and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. We have reached the end of 2024. I wish I had some fancy way of saying that that ties in beautifully to Crystal Palace's season. But, you know, we're on the back of a pretty good result, I'd say. Southampton 2-1 victory. Also played Bournemouth in a slightly less glamorous fixture. But I'm delighted to say that for this week's episode, I am joined by Ollie Thomas, a.k.a. Talk CPFC. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, mate. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Doing fantastic. I think there's nothing better than ending the calendar year with a good league win. And the other guest on the podcast today is Max. Max, I didn't really think ahead about how I'd introduce you, but we'll just run with Max. How are you, mate?
Yeah, no, I'm fantastic, mate. Thank you very much for having me on. Grateful to be here.
Yeah, well, obviously the two of you, I think, were both in attendance at the Southampton game, and I was as well sitting in the Arthur Waite. How did you guys find it from the stands?
I was going to say, I thought it was a good watch at times. I definitely enjoyed it. HF loud as usual, sat in lower home style. So, yeah, I thought it was a good atmosphere. Definitely enjoyed the match. Just definitely think we could have scored a few more, but happy with the win, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, I kind of thought the same. It was a bit of a weird one because at halftime there was a bit of a meltdown amongst some of the people I was watching with. But, I mean, we could and should have been 3-1 up or arguably 3-0 up. Like, I think we defended pretty badly for their first goal. But other than that, they didn't really do anything at all and we should have scored more. So I think, honestly, given how many games we've played this season where we've been good and not won, I don't care how we play as long as we win. And that was one of those. It's just like the 3 points is way more important than any performances, I think, on Sunday.
Yeah, it was quite typical of a Palace under Glasner this season kind of performance. You know, you saw us create loads of chances but also miss loads of sitters. You know, Munoz missing from open goal wasn't dissimilar to his performance at Newcastle. We saw Lerma with an overhead kick saved, possibilities of goals being ruled out. Luck swung our way yesterday, but we definitely had the quality to beat Southampton, I think would be my take on it. You know, they had one moment, one lapse in concentration, as was the case at Newcastle with that free kick goal where we switched off. We just couldn't deal with the pace of Kyle Walker-Peters. I think Munoz wasn't expecting him to have so much pace around the outside. You were both sitting in the home still, so Max, I'll bring you in on that. How do you think Munoz got beaten for pace so heavily there?
Honestly, it's not something that you see very often, is it, seeing Munoz getting beaten for pace down that right-hand side? But the people that were around me, just as the cross came in, people were saying it's like Munoz wasn't expecting him to go like towards the byline. And then you could kind of see as soon as he's beating him, Munoz was kind of like backed off straight away thinking, I'm going to give away a pen here. So I don't know. It's not seeing, like I said, seeing Munoz beat for pace isn't something that we see very often. But again, that was, like you said earlier, that was literally all they had the entire game. So I'm not too worried about it. But yeah, it wasn't the best of starts, but we grew into the game. So
I agree with the point of him going onto his left. Like, I didn't expect it either. So I'm sure, like, I think when you have an inverted fullback, it's quite rare that they go and just attack the byline. And he did it very effectively. I think after that, he tried to do it a few times as well. And Munoz kind of figured it out. It wasn't a case of, you know, him just being like beaten for pace on the day. I think he did just get genuinely done by Walker Peters for their goal. And then after that, he learned from it. And there was one, I think just after we equalised, where Walker Peters went to do the same thing again. Munoz tackled him, went out for a corner, and he like properly celebrated it, which I thought was quite funny considering he just got beaten for a goal doing exactly the same move. But at least he learned from it.
I think, yeah, that shows the emphasis though that our team kind of has on fixing their mistakes. That's been kind of the theme of this season, is players getting beaten once and then learning from it. I think we've been quite solid defensively when we do get beaten for something, whether that's, you know, a corner goal, or in this case Munoz getting beaten for pace around that side, sort of getting dummied, or also Martinelli against Mitchell with that cross going around the outside as well. We've tended to sort of pick ourselves up and analyse it and come out stronger from it. We've just had such a negative starting position, because of course this is the last podcast of the year, so we will do some general roundup talk as well. Just going back to Southampton though for the minute, who do you think stood out? Like, it was a good performance. Like I said, we've got quality. So Max, I'll start with you. What were the performances you highlighted from it?
Well, I think the obvious one, obviously, is Sarr. I think he just, the way that Southampton set up really suited him, because I think that Southampton, they were obviously doubled up on Eze in first half, and then that kind of allowed Sarr to kind of have this space and just do what he does best with just his direct running. Very, very unlucky, I think, with his one-on-one. It was a tremendous save from Ramsdale. But I think Lacroix has to always get a mention. He's just, at the minute, just very, very strong as usual. I think Hughes was okay. I think he was pretty strong.
That FYP mug, I think Will Hughes did all right. You know, if you've seen that 5-year plan, have that bit of merch. It's just like, it was good for Hughes, but he certainly did pretty, really well, given he needed 5 stitches put in his foot at halftime.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he got like stepped on and scraped in the first half and played another sort of 30 minutes with, you know, stitches in his foot, which is pretty mental. But you'd expect it from a player of his kind of toughness.
Yeah, well, in that case, he did really, really well then. I do want to mention something about Mateta, though, because I think, obviously, Bednarek was absolutely all over him first half. I don't know how a ref didn't give 4 or 5 fouls. Every time the long ball came over, he was all over him. But what I really liked was Mateta's ability to just be that target man that he is. I think yesterday that worked really well.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say Mateta was someone who stood out for me, especially in the first half, because I think Southampton really, their press completely like nullified us playing out from the back, and you could see we just had no idea how to play through it. And I think it was games like yesterday where we really miss Wharton. Like, even though Hughes is pretty good at receiving the ball deep, like, Wharton in those situations is happy to receive the ball with 3 players around him and still try and do something. And I think we had to go long so often, and Mateta was just constantly winning it, like, almost every single time. And so Bednarek just couldn't handle him at all. But I think Mateta's just done that really well this year. Like, even though his own output hasn't been as good as it was at the end of last season, but that's fine. Like, it was ridiculous at the end of last season. I think him and Eze I know Eze's got a lot of heat over the last few weeks, but I think they've both kind of been willing to sacrifice their own output a bit in order to make the team better. And I think they've had to both do something a bit different now to enable Sarr to be good. So they're having to drop in more and hold the ball up more and flick on rather than be on the end of the Elise balls. And I think yesterday was a really good example of that. Like, Sarr has got so much better because he's got way less to do. He doesn't have to go and get the ball in central midfield and ping a ball across to Mitchell anymore. He can just run in a straight line, and that gets the best out of everyone, kind of.
Yeah, that's a really good point on Ismaila Sarr, actually, and the relationship with the strikers around him. We saw sort of earlier in his time at Palace, he'd be picking up the ball in the halfway line, trying to turn and just getting tackled, almost acting like a striker, just because of where he was forced to come to receive the ball. Whilst we've kind of pivoted over the last few weeks to a strategy where we hoof the ball up to a striker, which did admittedly get some criticism from people in the stands next to me calling it a boring style of football, but it paid off at Brighton with Nketiah pulling off that flick on to Sarr to run onto it against Dunk, and the exact same thing happened with JP for Sarr for that one-on-one with Ramsdale. And the other player you brought up, Eberechi Eze, I think he might have just had that season-turning moment with that goal yesterday. I mean, it was a beautiful strike, maybe a bit fortuitous with how it came about, although good work from Munoz to chase the follow-up from Mitchell. But after that goal, you could really see a change in how he was playing. He was more confident. You know, he won that free kick, flicking the ball over. I think it was Bednarek. And took a free kick, which almost went in afterwards. But he just looked a bit more like his old self, the self that we saw with Michael Olise. And hopefully with further strength in January, we can, you know, maybe give him a rest or give him more skills and firepower around him. But Ollie, do you think that's a moment for him to kick on this season?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think you could see as well the way everyone else celebrated was quite sweet. Like, everyone seemed pretty happy for him. And I think he's been unlucky this season, like, a lot of the time. And Eze is such a confidence player, and he always has been a confidence player. And I think, like, obviously, you know, as a team, we've played all right for most of the season. But I think Eze, obviously, without Elise, he's really struggled. And it's not just like him being the main man and he can't handle the pressure of being the main man. It's that, like, he has no one around him who can take that burden of, like, build up off him, especially without Wharton either. I think it was a really good finish hit it so sweetly as well. And I hope it can turn it around for him. Because again, like coming back from injury, it's just been a bit of a stop-start season for him, I think, which hasn't helped. And I think, yeah, you're right. If we can get some kind of reinforcements in Jan, then I think he can really kick on.
And while we're on the topic of goals, obviously Trevor Chalobah got his third of the season, all three from set pieces, the first being that excellent volley against Wolves and two sort of slightly scrappier goals since then against Brighton and now Southampton. Max, what did you make of his overall performance and the goal in particular? Do you think it was a foul from Mateta?
I thought, well, from obviously from Homesdale, you haven't really got a clue in real time. You can't sit here and say either way in real time. But looking at the replays, I think that just is allowed now. You know, Gladstone's comments after the game about, you know, in any league in the world apart from the Premier League, that's a foul. And from what I can see, Mateta's kind of he's got his hand on Ramsdale, but nothing else. He doesn't really seem to push him with any force. He doesn't really seem to do much else. And in the match today analysis, they were saying about how what they needed to do was put someone in between JP and Ramsdale, stop that from happening. So I think they just got punished. I think if it's given against us, are we arguing the other way? But I don't know. Chalobah was there. And what I really liked and what I did want to mention was, we have seen it before, but when Munoz pushes so high, it actually invites Chalobah to join the attack as well. When he was driving the ball forward, and he was, at times, that's when I do watch Palace play, sometimes it's so excruciatingly annoying when we're just not driving the ball forward and just slowing the attack down. And I think Trev did really well yesterday, kind of slotting into that kind of right midfield role, which just allowed Munoz to just attack more.
Yeah, there was like a 5-minute period in that first half where he picked up the ball a couple of times, drove forward and sent a ball into the box, I think twice. And it was the first time we've seen him kind of attempt what we kind of called on the podcast last season, the Nathaniel Clyne role, that sort of support right-sided centre-back that gave us a lot of attacking sort of fluidity last season. You know, Wolves, for example, Mateta's goal came from a Clyne run overlapping with Elise. And if Chalobah can do more of that, I think that could be pretty important for our system this season, because we've struggled, like you said, with players driving forward. Ollie, is there anything you want to add?
I completely agree. I was going to name check Nathaniel Clyne as someone who did that really well. I think that was probably, in a lot of ways, Chalobah's best performance for us this season, like in terms of how aggressive he was. I've been a little bit disappointed with him, to be honest. I was really excited when he signed, and I thought that he would be like a formidable part of our back three, and I'd say that he has definitely been the worst of Lacroix, Gehi and him. That's not that bad, because Lacroix and Gehi are obviously really good, but I think if he can like have that trust in the team around him and push forward like that, he'll offer a lot more. Like there was one, especially when I think we were 1-0 down, and he was just like completely free on the right wing and like put a ball in. It's like, if you do that more, it means Munoz can support the attack more as well, which he's really good at doing. And it just makes the team flow better. Again, I think Chalobah's probably a bit of a confidence player too. He had like the way he left Chelsea, I know it was only on loan, but it must have been pretty demoralizing for him, like forced to train by himself, etc. So I think maybe he's just warming up to it as well. And I mean, I feel like the fact that we were dreadful at corners and now we're actually really good at them has kind of flown under the radar a bit. Like, obviously we went like 2.5 years or whatever it was without scoring a single one. And now we've scored like quite a few like free kicks and corners this season, which is nice to have that threat again, because previously it was just basically a waste of time, us having a set piece. Whereas now, you know, we've got a pretty good conversion rate, at least compared to what it was.
Yeah, I mean, part of that you'd think is the switch to Will Hughes being on them instead of, you know, Eze and Elise, who were kind of rotating for last season. Even Wharton took them at some time. Deveny's actually come on and done quite well when he's taken corners. I think that was in the lead up to multiple chances we've had, and he had one really good free kick against Fulham as well. So maybe it's just that sort of left-footed type player, because Kamada came on, took a few corners, and that wasn't quite to the same standard. But I'd say the biggest change in that time, obviously it was since Bournemouth 2022 until I mean, only a couple months ago that we hadn't scored. So yeah, nearly 2 years. And it's signing big centre-backs and having more of them on the pitch. We've now got, what, Mateta is you know, 6 foot 4 forward. Lacroix and Chalobah have come in this season. Munoz can jump pretty high, and Lerma is an aerial presence. The way that man jumps is ridiculous, and that kind of leads me into wanting to talk on Jefferson Lerma, because I was actually there with my uncle, who's from Colombia, so we were kind of on Lerma and Munoz watch, and I could feel a lot of frustration at the way Lerma was playing. I mean, he has this habit of maybe slowing the game down when he shouldn't, or taking an extra touch when he should be shooting, or just doing something a little bit loose, but he works so hard in my view, and the way he, you know, created that chance for himself in that first half, playing 1-2s with Will Hughes and shooting from the edge of the box. That was something we haven't seen, a drive from midfield in recent memory as a Palace fan, with midfielders like Hughes, Decore, Warden, who don't really have that tenacity. So, Max, do you think Lerma, you know, put on a good enough performance yesterday to warrant staying in the team, and or is he the one that you'd see dropped once Warden returns from injury?
I think with the way that Hughes has been playing, I think it would be harsh to drop him. I think Hughes has just done more than Lerma. But in terms of yesterday, he ran a lot. One thing that did impress me, he was still right at the end of the second half. He was still chasing those balls down, and quite often he's actually the only one doing it. So I do want to recognise that. But there was the one Lerma moment yesterday that I remember was when it was like a nice counter-attack, few 1-2s down the right-hand side. Somehow we've ended up with Lerma with the ball on the right wing. And then he's put this cross in, and it's just gone honestly, the groans from the Homesdale. It was, after such a promising counter, to finish with that, it just makes me feel like, why was he the one there? Why was he playing that cross? But also, should he not have a bit more quality to be able to deliver something better? Was that even the best option? I don't know, but I do think he is the person that he's a player that I would drop when Wharton comes in. I don't think he had a horrific game, but yeah, that'd be what I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think in the first half, I mentioned earlier that I thought Southampton really suffocated us in terms of playing out from the back, and Lerma does not help in those situations. Like, he's not someone who's willing to come and get the ball at all. And I think in games like that, you really miss, as I said, like a Wharton, or even Decore was good at doing that too. I do think, though, like in other games where it's a bit more even and we're playing better teams, Lerma brings a level of energy that like no one else in our team can really offer, outside of Munoz, actually, probably. But like, he works so hard defensively, and if we're defending a lead or if we're anticipating not having much of the ball, Lerma is really good, and he can be quite aggressive as well. The one thing I worry about, though, is that it felt like last season, obviously on paper, Wharton and Hughes is not a very mobile midfield, not very defensively strong, but we were so good at just like suffocating teams, like with like Richards and Anderson and Klein, like we could just pen teams in so easily. I do wonder, obviously there's been a lot of change in the team since then, I wonder if Wharton and Hughes will still work with the same personnel. Like, I find it a bit weird because obviously I think Chalobah and Lacroix, and obviously Gehi too, are really mobile defenders who should be able to defend counterattacks really well. But it still feels, to an extent, like they don't really back themselves, or like I still feel like we play 5 yards deeper than we could. But maybe that's, I guess that's, if you've got Saar, you need space in behind, so you kind of need to invite the team onto you as well. It's a bit of, I can see there being a bit of a change in how we approach things if we sign people in January, because I feel like something just isn't quite gelling, even though players are playing individually really well.
Yeah, I mean, you've pointed out that flexibility of sort of how we're playing now versus how we might in January. I think, you know, with Will Hughes, someone who could, you know, be out of the team, or Lerma, someone who could be out of the team, you've also got Tyrick Mitchell, who I think his days as a guaranteed starter may be reaching an end. I think he might be, you know, finding his place up for competition with a new signing soon. And then finally, the role of Saar in the way we set up, we do, you're right, sort of set up a bit deeper than we could, giving Saar that sort of forward freedom. But, you know, if we were to sign a Cherky or a McAtee, which we'll get onto later, maybe, you know, we wouldn't need to do that, and we'd be a bit more compressed, because we definitely do seem a bit stretched, especially when would be encountered against as well, because Hughes simply doesn't have that pace to get back. And once Loma does do that, he tends to overcommit and end up in weird positions. But that kind of brings me on to the final thing I wanted to talk about with Southampton, which was Chris Richards, who obviously had to come in for Mark Gay, who was suspended and will play the next game as well against Chelsea, most likely, given that Trevor Chalobah can't play against his loaning side. So we'll get Chris Richards for another game. Max, how did you feel he fared?
Well, I want to say that that was probably the best game to not have Gay, to not have Mark starting. You know, we are playing Southampton at home. That is the one game you choose not to have him playing. But I don't think Richards did badly. I think there was mistakes in there, but I think you could just tell that he wasn't. He was the, I don't want to say odd one out, but he's not the usual starter in that back three. I think at times it was quite obvious. And I think arguably he was going against an attack that really wasn't going to punish his mistakes. And I think that did happen. But I do think it also shows that he's not, there's a reason that we stick with those three and that Richards hasn't really had a look in.
Yeah, I was actually hoping to see Chaddy Riyad on Sunday. I saw he was on the bench, and I know he only came back a few weeks ago for the under 23s, but I just thought he would have slotted in nicely there. Like, and I know that, I think it was against West Ham he played, and he was pretty shaky at points, but you could like see that, like, he was quite brave with his passing. You could see that he's like a big, strong lad. And I don't know, I probably would have preferred him to get minutes to Richards, but equally, Rich, you kind of know what you're getting from Richards. Like, he's not going to drop any clangers, and like, he's fair, and he can be really good. Like, again, to be fair to him, at the end of last season in the left centre back role, he was quality for a few months. But yeah, it was, there's something about him which I kind of just don't really trust that much anymore. It's quite a funny thought, like, looking back, how people were like so desperate for him to play right back for ages when we had Ward and Klein still. It's quite funny, like, looking back. I mean, Roy Hodgson was probably fair to not play him as a marauding right back for a few months.
Well, you can't forget the one game he did actually play him at right back. We conceded after 17 seconds to Ben Brereton Diaz at home against Sheffield. Which was a pretty grim day. I think that thing with Richards is he's a little immobile. Even though his top speed's pretty quick, he can sort of just feel a little bit slow at the same time, maybe a bit sluggish to get up to pace. And he's also just a bit generally anonymous when he plays. When you think back to the run where he, Anderson and Klein, obviously three players that aren't even part of our starting best three now at the back, during that winning run last season, he was the one people mentioned the least, because you had Klein's runs and Anderson's dominance, but people didn't really call on Richards. And obviously he's had those injuries that have kept him out as well. But it does raise a question, because there's a lot of hesitance now about Richards as a right-sided centre-back, despite being right-footed, and kind of seeing him more as a left-sided backup. And that's where he played against Southampton in Gehi's absence. But with Gehi coming back and Chalobah being the right centre-back, we'll now have to see Richards most likely play on that right side. Or Mark Gehi plays there internationally, so he could play on the right side. But then there's Chaddy Riyad now, who's an actual left-footed, left-sided centre-back. So there's this kind of issue now where we don't really, other than Klein, who's a right-back by trade, have a natural best option backup right-sided centre-back. And now we've got these two players on the left. So I think there's probably going to be an uncomfortable outcome there by the end of the season, where most likely Richards could potentially be moved on due to the emergence of Chaddy Riyad, or even potentially a loan for Chaddy if he doesn't manage to break in. I guess we'll see probably both play, maybe Richards on the right, Chaddy on the left in the FA Cup at home against Stockport in January. So there's that. But I'll sort of wrap up Southampton there. I think we've covered most of the talking points, and move into sort of the year in review awards that I wanted to hand out. So the first one is best signing. Now, that can be anyone signed from January or in the summer window as well. So Max, let's start with you. Who was your best signing of 2024?
I think it wasn't a tough one for me. It has to be Daniel Munoz. I think the impact of him on that, I know Glasner came in and completely, you know, stamped his way of football, his style of football on our team. But the way that Munoz fit in and played that role so well. He's transformed the attack, but then his ability to come back on defence as well with his speed and his defending ability. I really wanted to say Adam Wharton for this question. Like, I really, really wanted to. But I just think it would be unfair, considering his injury this season that's obviously really set him back. And when Munoz played, don't get me wrong, there's been a couple of games this season where Munoz has been slightly disappointing. I remember watching him at, I believe, Wolves away, I think it was, and Forest away as well. He just seemed to do that, again, that Palace thing that we talk about, of just slowing the attack down, which wasn't something that he used to do. But apart from that, I think it has to be Munoz for all the benefits I spoke about earlier.
I would completely agree with that. Like, I think Wharton is the best player we have signed, but Munoz has just completely changed the team. Like, he's so important to how we play. And also value. Like, he costs like barely anything. And you think about how often he plays, how important he is now, everything he does offensively, defensively. Like, he's just been a complete revelation. And so, so different. To, like, we play so differently now, and he's such a different right back to what we've had previously. So yeah, definitely him. I've really enjoyed watching him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the exact point that I've been making to people, and when they've asked me this question, you know, I feel like if we don't sign Munoz, because obviously that's a Roy Hodgson signing and someone who'd previously played in a back four but had that attacking output, scored 8 goals I think in the year leading up to him signing for us. And you know, with us bringing in Glasner to replace Roy Hodgson and playing that five back, I can't see us going on that run of games or even staying up with Klein at right wing back and Ward at right centre back, because we had Mark Gehi out with a serious knee injury and it crippled our back three. And obviously Lerma, who'd come in and was filling in at centre back, was also injured as well for a good stretch of that. So we would have been forced to play Joel Ward at centre back and Klein at right wing back, which, you know, might have even bottled us into a back four, which Glasner was less familiar with. I just think Munoz was so critical to our survival last season, and now the new way we're playing. And thankfully, he's recently added goals to his game as well, even though he's still missing the odd sitter. Worst disappointment of 2024, Ollie. Let's start with you this time.
I mean, there's actually, unfortunately, a few candidates for this. And I don't want to, like, I feel like he gets jumped on a lot, and I do think he's got a bit better in recent weeks, but it does have to be Kamada, really. Like, I know some people would probably say Nketiah. I think there are glimpses with Nketiah where you can see that with a run of games playing up front, he will be good. And I think he's got a good long-term future at Palace there. You know, I think at some point Mateta will want to leave and whatnot. And I know he costs a lot of money, Nketiah, but Kamada is meant to be like, it doesn't even feel like he's struggling to adapt. It's just he's struggling to do the absolute basics of football. Like, there were points earlier in the season so often where he'd get the ball in the middle of the pitch, Munoz is running down the right wing and he's putting the ball out of play, or he's putting it behind him, or he's not reaching him at all. And it's like, that's not struggling to adapt to the physical demands of the Premier League. That's not being able to hit a 30-yard pass and you're meant to be a creative midfielder. Again, some of it's not his fault. I think he's had to play deeper than he would have liked before, and he's kind of not been able to play at all in Eze's position, which is probably where he would want to play. But, I mean, he has been incredibly disappointing this season, even though he was a free transfer. He's obviously our highest earner as well, so it's definitely him. Sorry, Daichi.
I think you just have to agree, don't you, that Kamada has been the biggest disappointment. I know he came on a free, which it seems to be a bit of a talking point that, you know, I saw something the other day that was, if you, with like the contract length and the wages he's paying, the transfer works out at like 10 mil all in, something like that, which based on his performances so far seems like too much. But I think, yeah, Kamada's just really, really struggled in the Premier League. I don't even need to repeat the things that Ollie said, but Nketiah, I know that Nketiah was the other player that I was going to mention, and I, for one, was a little bit confused when all of a sudden the rumour started to come around that we were going in for Nketiah, because with the system that we played last season, I didn't understand why we were bringing Nketiah in. And then because we've Gladstone's tried to play him as that left-sided 10, which he just isn't. He is that 9. And because he isn't ever going to get in over JP, I questioned where he was going to fit and how is he going to fit in the system. Because I just think since Sarr has come in, he has just made such a better impact than Eddie has. So, yeah, I'm basically just echoing what Ollie said, but yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, I think the most depressing factor in both of those players' sort of outcomes so far at Palace is how it's not just the fans that have turned on them, or, well, turned on them is a bit harsh, but changed their view of their quality. You know, the way that they're playing and the minutes that they're receiving have changed so much from what they were intended to be. Nkessie was brought in to try and add definitive quality to our front line. I think there was a view of the sort of Palace hierarchy that his sort of shorter height and ability on the ball meant he could play either side in a kind of deeper 10 role. But I think that maybe would work as a single 10 rather than in a left or a right sense, because he's just a more technical player. But we also kind of haven't seen that. His first touch at times has been appalling, and the same applies to Daichi Kamada. And if you sort of take the money away, neither are being the players they're brought in to be. You know, we've signed Kamada, someone who was meant to be sort of Glasner's star boy, and he's gone from being someone we saw as the Elise replacement potentially to someone that can't get brought on until there are 10 minutes to go to see out a win. I'd honestly, and I think many fans would agree, rather see one of the kids brought on to change something, like with us chasing a game rather than Daichi Kamada, because I feel significantly weaker with him on the pitch, and I feel like that's a predictable outcome rather than one of those kids that's wild card. Maybe that's just me. But I think the name that I haven't heard so far, which is probably due to his injury problems, is Mateus França. I know he was signed last summer, but he's still been pretty disappointing in the year of 2024, only playing about 5 games before picking up an injury and then again and then again. And there's a sense, I think, with how Glasner's spoken about him in press conferences, that, you know, if he were to pick up another injury now, that would basically be it. Obviously, we've had horrible luck with injuries, Nathan Ferguson, etc. But, you know, França is kind of the wild card pick. I'll agree with you guys on Nkessie and Kamada, but, you know, France's not set anything alight for the 20 million odd fee that he was signed for. Let's move on to the next one, which is unsung hero of 2024, Max.
So I don't know if people would say he's unsung enough for this award, but I'm giving it to Dean Henderson, because I do think that there has been games where he's actually kept us in games. He is an unbelievable shot stopper. His kicking has improved recently as well. Especially, I noticed it against Southampton. Pretty much every goal kick was landed on JP's head, and that's not something that we used to see with Dino. And I just think sometimes he does just pull out just crazy saves that, like I say, do keep us in games. I did have Will Hughes written down, but I would stay with Dino.
Those are my two as well. I think I'm going to give it to Hughes mainly because of at the end of last season. As I think this season he's got a lot of praise, and rightly so, and the fact that he's been like a mainstay with a lot of people around him getting injured and whatnot, he's like, it's been really important that he's been very available. And like, I think, you know, he's been, you know, had a few injuries down the line before, and he's just like always been there when we need him this season. But I thought last year he was brilliant alongside Wharton. Like, obviously Wharton was amazing, but I don't think Hughes was much worse than him. But because there were so many good players, and Wharton was super exciting, and Elise was doing his thing, and Mateta and Eze, I think at the end of last season, he was like quite underrated. Same with Nathaniel Clyne. But if Clyne had played more this season, maybe. I think if we're talking about exclusively last season, I would definitely say Clyne. But obviously, he's barely played this year. So I'll give it to Hughes for kind of being underrated last season and maybe just like underappreciated consistency this season sometimes. But Henderson is a good shout. Henderson, people still love to hate Henderson. I don't know why. That was getting rid of Sam Johnson for 10 mil and keeping Henderson was very good business in hindsight.
Yeah, the guy behind me at Palace on Saturday, on Sunday rather, was like, I still don't know why we sold Henderson. I much prefer Johnson. I believe his logic was he loves a skinhead keeper. So maybe questionable on the footballing knowledge there. But yeah, I think Dino's been pretty outstanding this season and kept us in quite a lot of games. But he also goes quite absent in the ones we tend to get hammered in. You know, he didn't make a single save against Arsenal. Part of that was down to their finishing quality, but he can sometimes kind of drift in and out of being influential as a goalkeeper, but hopefully he can just become more consistent. But yeah, let's move on to the penultimate category, which is one to watch for 2025. Ollie, do you have a candidate that springs to mind?
It's difficult to pick one without sounding overly optimistic about players that maybe aren't doing that well. But I think I'm going to give it to Franca, Matheus Franca. I know you had him as the worst disappointment. I just think there were things about him when he played where I thought like he's got some really good fundamentals in terms of like his ball carrying and he's rapid. And I think the thing that was lacking from him was his decision making at times. Well, almost all of the time, but it felt like that's easier to fix than someone who's just like can't control the football and can't run quickly. But he can do both of those things. And I think, as someone who is like, I think he can be nicely eased into the team. Like, he doesn't have to be, I don't think there's going to be much pressure on him necessarily. But I saw something. I saw something about him at the beginning of this year where I thought, I think he could be good. I did want to say Nketiah as well, but I just like Nketiah. The fact we spent 50 mil combined on Nketiah and Franca is crazy when you think about it. It's crazy. But yeah, I'll go Franca just about.
Franca isn't actually someone that I'd thought of because he's made what, like a total of 12 appearances for the club. Quite often I feel like he kind of slips my mind. But I actually agree with Ollie. I really, really want Franca to come with something. Like, I really, really do. And like Ollie says, he just has those like characteristics of a good footballer. And because he's come from that Brazilian league, maybe his poor decision making at times wasn't necessarily as when you make those poor decisions in the Premier League, it will very much have a consequence. And I feel like maybe that he doesn't come from the background of that. But I really wanted to say Deveni, just because when he did come in to that role, when we needed a 10 who was fit and wasn't horrifically poor at the start of the season, I do think Deveni did a good job. However, is he going to have a long-term future at Crystal Palace? Probably not. But I don't know. I just think he was really nice when he came in due to the injuries. But I don't know if this is one to watch as such, but I just think Sarr's going to get better and better. That is at Sarr is my pick. I know he starts now. And he is, pivotal to our team, but I do just think he's going to get better and better. And as hopefully, as we talk about soon, the recruitment in January, if that kind of acts as like a catalyst for how he plays, I think Sarr could just get better and better.
Yeah, I think Sarr is actually really interesting. I hadn't even thought about it. I was torn between Lacroix and Wharton. Obviously, they're two players that we haven't really mentioned yet, but they're also two players we've seen kind of be as good as we'd expect them to be already in a Palace shirt. Like, I think Lacroix has exceeded expectations. Wharton exceeded expectations when he was fit. And we kind of, I think maybe just assume that that's the best that they can get. But they're both, really quite young. Wharton is 20. And Lacroix is only what, 4 years older? And for a centre back, that's still pretty young. He's still got a lot to learn in terms of his positional awareness and knowing when to make a challenge. As we saw yesterday, he got beaten by that midfielder of theirs when he slid in. But his build Lacroix, I think, is so, so good for a centre back. And although he runs like he's about to pop his hamstring, he is so, so rapid. And he's got all the physical and honestly technical traits to make a really, really good sort of Champions League level defender. So, you know, if Glasner can coach him well, something he's done in the past to already make him one of the best defenders that league, that season rather, in the Bundesliga, you know, he could go to a whole new level. And Wharton kind of the same. We haven't seen a fit Wharton under Glasner for a while, so it's easy to forget how good he was. But, you know, every game he was man of the match basically at the end of last season, if Elise didn't outplay him, to the point where he went from a championship midfielder to making England's Euro squad in 6 months. So I'm torn between the two of them. I'm not going to say Eddie Nketiah because I can't see him being anything really, to be honest, Ollie. I'm sorry, I know you love him, but
James,
he's just not in the build of a Glasner striker, although he can work miracles with them, as we've seen over the years. So yeah, I guess on a toss up, I'll call it Wharton, just because he's younger and he's been injured for a bit, so it's easy to forget how good he can be. But that brings us to our final category, which is best player of 2024. I honestly can't even make my mind up, but Max, what do you think?
Just like I said earlier, really want it. Like, I want to give this to Adam Wharton. I really do, just because of his impact when he came in. In the end of last season, he just transformed our midfield completely, and our transition from defence to attack just completely was reinvented from Wharton. But my best player is JP. It is, because I just don't think the improvement of that man cannot be ignored. His finishing got better. He just learned to play to his strengths a lot more. Obviously, I think he is one of the best hold-up strikers there is around. I know we were talking about it earlier, but Bednarek yesterday, absolutely all over him. And just like Ollie said, he won pretty much every header. His finishing, I just think... I know when he had, you know, the holy duo next to him, it obviously made him even better. But I just think he has that quality. Maybe not every single game, but he just has that quality that we need to score goals. So JP is my best player.
Yeah, I would have Mateta, and I honestly don't think it's that close. Like, I just think that when I think about what you want in a striker in the Prem, I just don't really see what Mateta doesn't have. Like, I trust him carrying the ball. He can hold it up, as you said. His finishing on both feet is brilliant. Like, I can't remember trusting a striker in front of goal much more than JP, to be honest. And I think obviously there's a nice narrative there as well. Like, you think about, you know, imagine telling someone this time a year ago that Mateta would be crowned our best player of 2024 by a distance, ahead of Gehi, ahead of Eze, ahead of Elise. Well, maybe Elise is unfair because he didn't play the season, but you know what I mean. I just love him. I just think he's so good, and like he's worked hard to get better at things that he wasn't good at before, and now he's so important to that team. And again, I know Nketiah's not been as good as, you know, he maybe could have been, but I think there's not even been a question of dropping Mateta for Nketiah, and we spent 30 million on Nketiah. And that, like, again, to think about this time last year, imagine telling someone we'd spend that money on Nketiah and he'd be sat on the bench because Mateta's starting ahead of him every week. You would have been like, what the hell is going on? But that's just so normalised now. I love him. I love Mateta, and a great celebration, which automatically puts him top.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, to be honest. It's JP all the way. He just has everything you want in a striker, like you said. I remember I saw Stumpeg talking on Sky about Nottingham Forest, you know, maybe needing to upgrade their striker in Chris Wood, just because while he's scoring the goals, he's not doing everything else. I think Mateta's maybe in the opposite at the moment for us. You know, he's kind of doing everything else. I can't remember the last time he frustrated me. When he gets a chance, he pretty much takes them, with the exception of that miss against Arsenal. But he's also brought a creativity to his game. You know, he's gotten so good at improvisation. We saw flashes of it, obviously, with his first goal for the club against Brighton. But that flick at Luton earlier this year that went in, he dummied it for Munoz against Southampton, and that created a chance. His passing's gotten really good. His hold-up's gotten really good. That was a pass against Bournemouth where first time he flicked it over on the right-hand side to Munoz. And it's the type of pass I saw him do in Germany, actually, quite a few times. And I hadn't seen him do it for Palace. So it's really good to see his confidence sort of creatively sort of soaring to new heights. But yeah, it's JP as the best player of 2024. I was thinking it could be Michael Olise just because he's ridiculous. And honestly, in terms of like personal achievement of players that we started 2024 with, it's Michael Olise. But, you know, JP's gone into the same under 21 Euro squad or Olympic squad as Olise. So I'd say, yeah, JP.
I think his one thing that I have a very distinct memory of, I remember being sat at uni watching this, his goal against Ipswich. I just think the old Mateta that we knew, you would have no hope that would end up in the back of the net. And the confidence and the ability to perform the step over, leave the centre-back on his arse, and then have the audacity to hit it with his weak foot, with that power, I just think that is what JP Mateta is now. And that isn't something that, you know, like we say a year ago, we just wouldn't have seen JP do that. And that's just what he does now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's a pretty nice point to move into the final section of this podcast, which is transfer talk. Obviously, it's nearly that time of the year again, new year obviously, but also the January transfer window opens, a window that we're historically quite inactive in, with the exception of last season and maybe that year under Sam Allardyce as well. But I don't think many Palace fans could forget, or rather certainly have forgotten, due to how forgettable it is, that window where we signed no one but Erdal Rakip and God, who was the other one? Was it Yaroslaw? Surely not.
Didn't we get Saul off in that window as well?
I think we loaned in Saul off. We signed Saul off. We loaned in Rakip and we signed Yak.
And that goal, that Brazilian goalie?
Well, I think it was outside of the window.
Oh, right.
I think we got both Cavalieri and Lucas Perry in sort of quick succession on freeze. It was very, very strange time. But yeah, the rumour mill is maybe a little quieter than you'd expect, given how open we've been about our need for a forward in Elise's absence. Summer, we really didn't invest enough money in the summer, or rather invest the money wisely enough due to how much we spent on Nketiah. And of course, a left wing back, which was the role that Glasner felt we missed out on most on deadline day. There were rumours of Gosens, there were rumours of even Ben Chilwell. But now two names have kind of risen to the top, and that's El Hadji Malik Diouf and Jan Nicholas Bester. Now, in my sort of position, is sort of hearing what I do, I think Diouf is kind of the optimum first choice as a kind of attack-minded alternative to Mitchell. This is someone that has scored 8 goals in his last 25 games from left back in a back four. So he's quite the capable player, and he's actually quite tall, so he can deputise at left centre-back as well, a position which we know we have an abundance in already, but there's always that option. And then Jan Nicholas Bester, someone who's moved to Benfica and not really had the run of games to prove the talent that he showed he had at Heidenheim. You know, he's got a wonderful left foot. I don't think I've seen many left backs since Roberto Carlos hit a ball with such ferocity. So, Max, I'll bring you in on this as our sort of transfer specialist of the day. What are your thoughts on those two players?
I think, admittedly, I must say, I don't know too much about either of them. However, I've done my research since the rumours have come out, and I like Diouf more, mainly because he's younger. And I think, you know, Mitchell has had that kind of time of being that young backup, if you will. So I feel like it's kind of perfect to have that direct competition with Mitchell. And he just seems to offer so much attacking threat. And I think this brings me on nicely to, do we want another Munoz on the left-hand side? Is that what our system wants? Do we want to be able to push both fullbacks forward to them so that they're almost wingers then support the attack? Is that what we want? Or is it a case of, if we do have, so let's say we have Diouf there instead of Mitchell, and him and Munoz have both gone up to support the attack, are we then vulnerable? Is that a worry? If we then bring in this really attacking-minded left-back, which Mitchell isn't, and I know we've said before about how Mitchell's attacking output has improved. Bobby Manzi said the other day, it's still not good enough. Like, it just isn't for what we want now. And I hate to say it, because I do love Mitchell, but I think Diouf gives us this real attacking threat with his directness, his dribbling, he can finish. What do you say? Eight goals in 25 appearances.
Games, yeah.
Like, that's ridiculous for a left back. And I think, I know Munoz has been quite unlucky with his finishing and missing these sitters. But if we had another Munoz on the left-hand side, I just think it transforms the team. But like I said, do we then become vulnerable because we commit too much back? But that's a job for Glasner, not me.
But that's probably the trade-off, right? Is that Diouf being, you know, used to playing in a back four before and being taller, more physical, he's arguably a more defensive option than Jan-Nicolas Besta, who's a left mid, sort of less left midfield player by trade, who's renowned for his free kicks and long ball striking. He would offer a really different alternative to a Munoz-like player who's a runner. I mean, for me, I think I'm kind of seeing it in terms of annoyance. Where does it break down in our current system and how do we plug that hole? And for me, it's the amount of times that Tyrique Mitchell loses the ball sort of on that left flank, kind of in between the our box and their box. Because once he gets defending or playing out from pressure, he's fine. Once he's putting in crosses, Mitchell's crosses are generally quite good and they've improved massively this season. He's gotten some excellent assists. But he can't really run or dribble out of tight spaces or use his body all too well. And that's where Diouf, I think, provides a much better alternative to Tyrique Mitchell. And obviously his age means he's probably happier to sit, learn, deputize, and not be sort of super disrespectful to a player that, let's be honest, is one of the hardest workers in our team and has come from our academy in, you know, one way. And I love Tyrique Mitchell. So honestly, I'm definitely more on board with the Diouf signing than the Besta signing. And it seems like the club is as well. But that will move us on to the forward position or the sort of 10 position. We needed to sign a left-footed 10-type player after Elise left. That was definitely the move. And this season, we've attempted this sort of three-way fix of, you know, got the pace of Elise and Saar times three, I guess, because he's ridiculously rapid. And Kamada on paper was meant to provide some creativity, but that hasn't really happened. And in Wharton's absence, we've only been missing that, you know, all the more. So the two players we've been looking at who'd certainly provide creativity and flair are Rayan Cherki and James McAtee. So, Ollie, let's bring you in on those two players. Is there one? Let's make it quick. Would you favour out of the two?
I think I prefer McAtee. There's just, again, I'm a vibes merchant. There's something about Cherki which just, I just worry. I just worry about the way he fits in, really. But equally, One thing I'm very conscious of us doing is like really going all in on a formation, which I know you like when you're going wing backs, you have to get proper wing backs, for example, as we've spoken about. I think like, let's say worst case scenario, not that I'm a pessimist, worst case scenario, Oliver Glasner leaves Crystal Palace and we get a new manager in who is going to be able to play as a more like conventional right winger. Probably Cherki over McAtee, who I think has like played a lot as like a proper number 10 as well. I think either would be good. I lean towards McAtee again. Like, I'm a bit of a Prem experience merchant as well. And I feel like he's got a point to prove. Like, I think he's probably been a bit unlucky to not play as much for City this year as maybe he was promised or it was alluded to. So I'd go McAtee just, but honestly, anyone of that profile would be really good. Because then I still think at the start of the season that Sarr was better off the bench in a lot of ways. Like, imagine bringing Sarr on with like 20 minutes to go and you're winning a game. Like, and that happened against Chelsea when it was 1-1 and Sarr came on up front and Chelsea dropped like 5-10 yards because you could see Colwill and Fofana were just bricking it because he was so much quicker than them. And I think, obviously, Sarr's been great. I'm not saying he should be dropped, but I think him off the bench could just unlock a whole new element to our game. And like I mentioned earlier, I think in terms of general balance of a team and us being able to like press higher and maybe get the best out of Mateta and Eze further up the pitch, I think balance-wise, yeah, we need someone in that role. I'm happy with either. I'd probably prefer McAtee.
I guess it's just a case of what we can afford and what's realistic, you know.
Yeah.
Guardiola's come out and said McAtee may not be as open to a departure as we once thought. Cherky's had interest from clubs like Liverpool, PSG and Dortmund, Newcastle as well. So hopefully we just don't sign neither and end up in the same position that we started the season with. But I think that's all we've pretty much got time for today. So just like to say a massive thank you to Ollie Thomas / Talk CPFC for coming on our final pod of the year. Ollie, where should our listeners know to find you?
TikTok is the one I plug these days. I'm kind of weaning myself off Twitter, although it does mean I have no idea about Palace news half the time. Like, I hadn't even heard that we were linked to left wing back Juvor Best till like 2 days ago, and I was like, God, what am I doing? I'm going to be Talk CPFC. I've got to read CPFC more.
I'll take that as an opportunity to plug our website as well. So the Palace Way, thepalaceway.com, we put out all the transfer stories that you'll need. It's been a bit of a slow patch for us, but we're definitely going to be getting right back onto it once the new year has started. So stay tuned there and also on our Twitter as well. And Max as well, thank you so much for coming on and making your podcast debut with the Palace Way. You've been brilliant. Any final words from you?
No, other than my Twitter is Max_Morris with two S's at the end. Going to try and get a little bit more active on there. But yeah, absolutely loved it.
Well, thanks so much for coming on, Max. Thank you to the both of you. Let's hope Crystal Palace can start the year against Chelsea as we finished it against Southampton. That's all for us, and we'll see you all next week.